And teaching this stuff, I really enjoy it, and I learn a lot by doing it, and I've learned a lot and thought a lot about the gospel, thought a lot about the book of Mark, and thought a lot about this specific lens that we're looking through with the teaching aspect of it. And I don't think, again, that's something we're just kind of trying to shove a square peg into a round hole. Jesus is called teacher so many times, and it references him teaching, and teaching is this really important dynamic that is happening in the Gospels, and it's a really important dynamic that's happening in the first century and in the rest of the New Testament after Jesus is resurrected and ascends. So it's one of the things we're challenged to do, is go out and teach and make sure we're sharing the Gospel. So I think it's important, and I think it's interesting. We've talked a lot about kind of what Jesus taught. We've talked a lot about how he taught. I want you to think for a second and be willing to share with me who Jesus taught. Who did Jesus teach? I want you to think about the categories of students that learned from Jesus. Who did Jesus teach? What kinds of people? What types of people? What categories of people? Who did Jesus teach? Jack.
Well, he taught John the Baptist to an extent, because John didn't understand about, almost like Peter, I baptize you, you baptize me, and he said, you know, let it go for now.
All right.
And John was, definitely had a lot of zeal, a believer, he was making the path straight, he wasn't in the line with the Pharisees, or however you want to describe that, but he was not beyond teaching.
Yeah, John's almost in a category all his own. I don't know that there's anyone else like him, right? He doesn't wind up being an apostle. He dies during the time that Jesus is teaching. He's a prophet before Jesus. He's an individual who Jesus references several times as being really important. He baptizes Jesus. John's a unique character, all his own. No one else really in his category, and Jesus definitely taught him. Who else? Al.
Looking at your list up there, I'd say he tries to teach everybody. But specifically, I think he's trying to teach people about who he is, who his father is, why he is here. I think his primary purpose in my opinion is trying to teach us to have this relationship with the Lord, our God, and that he's a benevolent father to
all right.
us. And he's not restricted. He's not narrowing it down to just the Pharisees or just his apostles or just disciples. He's talking to everybody.
Okay.
He's talking to all generations. And he's trying to set the basis for Christianity.
Okay. Don't be hung up on my list. I should have hit that. That's connected to this, but that wasn't. Scan the list and look for people that he taught, but you're spot on. He certainly taught everyone, but you mentioned two specific categories that are interesting. You talked about the Pharisees. I think there's times he's trying to teach the Pharisees or anyone who was a Pharisee. There's times he's trying to teach his disciples. Those would be two categories of people that he's trying to teach. And when he does that, he's got to do it differently because those are different people coming at it from different viewpoints. And with different agendas and with more open minds and less open minds. And so that adjusts his message a little bit. But definitely those groups of people. Wally.
Well, he has a message for everyone. But specifically, it was those who would have ears to hear. Those are the ones he was able to teach. The ones that you can teach and the student may not learn. Teaching is not always imparting the learning. You may be, you know, providing the chance, the opportunity, but it requires something on the part of the hearer. And so he said he went to the sick, that he went to those who knew that they needed help, and he taught them. He taught in the temple when he drove out the money changers. So many different things, but
yeah.
Many of these people didn't learn the lesson. I'm sure, at least at the time,
Yeah.
Because Jesus continually or seemed often to say, if you have ears, you need to listen.
Yeah, that's really good, Wally. And he, I like how you said he taught sinners, which means he taught everybody, because everybody's a sinner. But I think there's more in that. I think he taught people who knew they were sinners. I think he taught everyone, and then there were people who knew they were sinners and said, I want to do something about that. You seem to have the words of life. What can I do about my sins, so to speak? And he gave them more. And he said, there is something that can be done about that. So I think that's another good category of people, Graham.
And think about the different classes, as you're describing. We read specifically people being described as rich, people as poor.
Good.
There were educated people. People who were religiously educated, there were lawyers, there were fishermen at the bottom who had, his own disciples who had no education, are described as having no education. There were Jews, there were Gentiles, there were men, there were women, there were children, people who were weak and sick. All kinds of people were described in all of those different categories.
Grant kind of exhausted the list right there. I mean, that's it. And I say that because I like to think, when we talk about teaching, we can't forget we're teaching something, but we're teaching someone. And the someone is a really important part of it. And I look at, one of my ahas in looking at this has been those disciples. And disciples is a word at times it could describe a large group of people, but Mark pretty specifically several times calls out the 12 disciples. 11 of which will turn into the 12 apostles. They are a specific and very unique group of people that he teaches that we get probably the most information about how he teaches. He taught things and then some people walked away dumbfounded. Some people said, I want more. He taught things and then tried to get out and then people would follow him and he would teach them more. The Sermon on the Mount is a great example of teaching, but probably more like a preaching dynamic, right? Where he's going to download some amazing information for people in one shot. And sort of the, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. He who wants to understand, understand. And if you don't want to understand, I get it. I'm sorry, but I'm going to tell you what the truth is. And I hope you want to hear more of the truth. But his disciples were very unique and very different. And I almost look at them as having this 3-year experience that is like an experience that some people in this room have probably had where you kind of leave home and you go away to college. They left their things and they followed him and they traveled with him. And that map that Zach shared a week ago, they traveled like all over the place with him for about a 3-year time period. And it's really interesting sometimes to look at how Jesus is teaching them and what Jesus is saying to them, because they are probably the most relatable group to us. They're the believers. They're the ones who say, I have ears to hear. I want more. I want to know what I understand. I get it. Their understanding increases the more they spend time with them. And eventually they're saying, I want to do something about this. I want to be involved in this. And I think they're a great lens to look at teaching and learning for us, because I think they experience a lot of what we experience. So my list that's up here is sort of taking a step back from the moment Jesus calls them and going through Mark up until the moment where I think they have their big aha, sort of their graduation, here's your degree, pomp and circumstance piece. Now there's more to learn. He's going to tell them, now I'm going to take you to another level. But it starts out when he called those disciples and he said, follow me and I'll make you fishers of men. Along the way, he's healing. He's healing people with unclean spirits. He's healing lepers. He's healing paralytics. He's healing people that have problems with their body physically. These disciples, the 12, are there when he is having these interactions with Pharisees where they're challenging him and saying, why do you eat with sinners? Why don't you observe the Sabbath? And Jesus is showing them how to respond to that and how to deal with that. And he's changing their thinking. I don't know, Richard. Is that showing up there? I'm getting a message that's telling me important updates are pending. I'm going to say, remind me later, please. All right. He's having this whole conversation about his family. Whoever does the will of God, he's my brother and sister and mother, as important as family is. He says, there's something bigger. There's something more important than that. And the disciples are taking that all in. And then he taught in parables. And he had that whole point where he said, I teach them in parables because I want them to come and want more. To you, I'll explain the parable and I'll give you the depth of it. So they were treated a little bit differently from that standpoint. He calmed the storm and then he looked at them and said, have you no faith? That's a question and a statement he's going to make to them over and over and over again, challenging them to have faith and to believe. And I think they are believing more and more all the time, but I think he wants them to believe in something really significant and really important. He heals the demon possessed. He does more healing. He has that whole conversation about a prophet not being honored in his hometown and among his own relatives. And they're there to see that rejection and then see him continue with his work. And then he puts him out in the field. We talked about that. He says, now it's time for you to go. I want you to go out and I want you to do something. And I want you to experience this teaching. And he sends the 12 out to heal and to cast out demons. He then miraculously feeds 5,000. And they're there for that. And he actively involves them in that. He walks on water in front of them. And with Peter, Peter comes out and walks with him for a while. But they don't understand how he does it and why he does it. And he again makes this comment about their faith. And Mark tells us they didn't understand about the loaves and about the miracles and about the things that Jesus had done. He heals more people. He challenges the Pharisees again. He talks to them about it's not what you put into you physically that matters. It's what's in your heart that comes out that is going to determine your relationship with me and your relationship with God. He feeds 4,000 and does that again. He sighs deeply and says no sign's going to be given to the Pharisees when they ask for a sign. And then when he tries to get his disciples to engage in that, we talked about on Sunday, they don't get it still. And he says, you still don't understand. But I think they were understanding some things along the way. I think he was just saying, you don't fully understand. You don't get it. And that's what got us up to Mark 8, verses 27 through 33. In Mark 8, 27 through 33, I think this is, as we were saying on Sunday when we were closing out, kind of for me anyway, I think it's kind of a critical and a key moment here. Because I think there's some acknowledgement from his disciples for the first time that Mark records, you're the Christ. You are who you say you are. We believe that. And I think he's going to say, congratulations, we've got you to a really important point. Now, I'm going to shift. I'm going to change the message a little bit. I'm going to change the approach a little bit. Because now that you understand that and you're there, I got to start preparing you for what's coming next. And by the way, in his 3-year ministry, this probably happens as we're getting close to, we're in the final months most likely leading up to his crucifixion and leading up to his resurrection. So this is happening at an important point, and I think you're going to see from here on in Mark, there's a little bit of a shift and a little bit of a change in what he's trying to do. It even says in here, after he says to Peter, who do you say that I am? It says, verse 31, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders. I think when he starts to teach that, I think they start to go, wait, I thought we got it. And now what you're telling us doesn't sound like at all that we got it. We thought you were going to be the king. We're not going to let you suffer. We're not going to let you go through all of this. He's got to be rejected by the elders. He's got to be rejected by the chief priests and the scribes. He's got to be killed. And after 3 days, he's got to rise again. And verse 32 says, and he said this plainly. He made it pretty clear to them. And that's when Peter goes, no way, I'm not going to let that happen. And he makes that statement, get behind me, Satan, for you're not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. All right, here's where we're going to pick up tonight. We're going to move through, we're going to talk about this passage, and then we're going to really take a look at Mark chapter 9 in total. So we're going to be doing some reading tonight. So, I need a volunteer, first of all, who wants to read Mark chapter 8, 34 through 38. Mark 8, 34 through 38, David Sanderson.
And calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels.
Okay. Who do you say that I am? You're the Messiah. You're Christ. Good. Now I'm going to speak to you plainly. I'm going to have to suffer and I'm going to have to die and I'm going to be rejected by the Jewish leadership. And they say, no, Peter says, no, we're not going to let that happen. And he says, get behind me, Satan. I'm about to tell you what it means to be a follower of Christ. Once you say, I believe Jesus is the Son of God. I believe that he's the Christ. That's in many respects for them, like their conversion moment. And he says, if that's what you believe, then I'm going to explain to you, and he calls the crowd over to hear it, here's what it means to be a follower of mine. And it's not glorious, and it's not pretty. It's going to be difficult, and it's going to be challenging. So, think about that passage, and kind of go to our questions we've been asking. With respect to that passage and that comment, what did he say? What was his message to his original audience? Does it apply to us today? And if so, how? How did he say it? What method did he use to communicate his message? And how was his message received? And what attitude or mindset is he displaying when he makes this comment to the crowd about what it means to follow him? Al.
To me, the pivotal verse is 36. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? I think he's saying that there is more than the physical world. There is more than you trying to make the king of the physical world. There is much more beyond that. And that's what I'm here to tell you about.
Right. Really complex concept, I think, for people to understand that there's more to this life that you're living here on this earth, that you're born and then you die, but it's bigger than that and it goes beyond that. That requires some belief. That requires some faith in that. That's a challenging and difficult thing to say, but he says it's your soul that's going to live on in eternity, and your soul matters and it's bigger, and what happens after your life is more important than what happens during it. We, I believe, are sitting here because we've accepted that. But I think we got to be reminded that that's the commitment that we've taken on. And so there's huge, this is like the beginning of explaining to people what it's going to mean to be a Christian, right? And I think that has all the application in the world to us when we're looking at that. What else? What else stands out to you about this passage, David?
I was thinking about this in the context of your original question, which is who's the audience, right? And it's always impressed me that his target audience, and we mentioned this in some of our examples, but his target audience was very simply the Jews at the highest level, right? There were several Gentiles who heard secondhand and were interested in stuff, but he always made it very clear the Jews are first, right? That's who I'm going after. And in the context of this, and your questions that you asked in the next slide, the reason why that's important is because they're the ones who would understand what the Christ is. The Gentiles would not have that clue. It wasn't until they saw him doing all these miraculous things and people start talking about him as the Son of God that became interesting to them. But just saying, hey, this is the Messiah, to them, what's that?
Yeah, that was going to require some more explanation,
right?
And that's... he's preparing some people to go out and do that. That's going to be an important moment in Acts when there's an expectation to go out. When he explains how you're going to go out and challenges people to go out and utilizes Paul, among others, to go out and preach the gospel to everyone around the globe. But you're right. His initial audience here is trying to change the thinking of the people who are closest to what this is all about, or who should be closest to what this is all about.
But there's still another message in here that is really... interesting to them as well, and that's the whole concept of the eternal soul, and this is how you obtain life, right? And even the word gospel is interesting in the context of the Jews, because to us, gospel is very simple. Hey, I now have the opportunity to have this relationship with God. The Jews already had a relationship with God, but they didn't have a way to maintain that relationship in good standing without slaughtering a bunch of animals, and even then they could never get it.
Right? Yeah.
So it's interesting to think about the concept of the gospel in their context, through their eyes, in light of what the questions were that you asked.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that, because I didn't really think about this, but in verse 35, whoever would save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake, and the gospels, which we know that's connected. The gospel is the good news of him. But he's preparing people for, you're the messenger of the good news. And when you go out and do that, your life will quite literally be on the line, right? So I think that's an important part of this. What else, Al?
I have a question. What do you suppose he meant when he says, pick up your cross? Because he has said now that he is going to be killed, that he is going to be spit upon and ignored, and he's not going to be honored. But now he's telling them, you have to pick up your cross. My question for all of us is, what does that mean to us? Are we supposed to pick up the cross? And if so, what is it?
Verse 34, when he calls them to him, if anyone would come after me, then what he's going to have to do is deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Your question is, what's it mean to take up your cross? What's it mean to have to take up your cross? It seems pretty twofold there. You got to deny yourself and you got to take up your cross and you got to follow him. And that's interesting in and of itself, because we look at that, yeah, he's crucified on a cross. But at the time he's saying this, he hasn't been crucified on a cross. But I think that statement's going to resonate with people later when they see him on the cross and say, I get it. I'm going to have to be willing to experience that, or be willing to follow that. So what do you think he means with this idea of take up your cross? Chris?
It's the whole concept of you sacrifice your life for God. Whatever that means, however that looks, it's not necessarily going to be actually being crucified on the cross, but there are aspects of our lives that are going to be not fun and unpleasant because of what we stand for and the things that we can and can't do. I can understand from someone from the world looking in, it's like, you know, he asks, like, what profit is it if you gain the whole world? And if you're out there, it's like, you gain the whole world. Even the most successful person in the world, and you gain the whole world. You know, and then to somebody in the world, that's what it's all about. What do you mean, what does it profit? You gain the whole world, you just achieved what everyone's trying to do. But, you know, it's getting out of that concept of, like, we're not stuck in this life. There's something beyond this. And that's, especially communicating with people of the world, that's where the big difference is just understanding that difference.
I think the cross for Jesus was the hardest thing he had to do. Right? We know he's going to pray that way in the Garden of Gethsemane before that. I think his cross was the hardest thing he had to do. I think he's saying, you're going to have to be willing to deal with the hardest thing you have to do, which is constant denial of self and constant willingness to set aside what is going on in this world and the trappings of this world and not be concerned with those things, but be concerned about the humble business of being a follower and a disciple. Evan?
I think he's also saying he's telling them that he's going to do this, but all this is going to happen now. I'm not exactly sure about part of it, but he's telling them, I'm going to do this stuff to you, and you're going to have to do hard things too. It's not just going to be just.
Yeah, I like the part there, Evan, about I'm going to do these things for you. I'm going to do these things for you. I think as he's saying this, that's why I can totally get behind Peter and anyone else who's, if nothing else, loved learning from him and loved spending time with him and loved being a part of changing people's lives and miracles and just being a part of that. And that's all going to end. Yeah, it's going to end, and it's going to end ugly is what he's saying. But when it does, I'm doing this for you. There's a greater purpose behind this. And I think he's prepping people now and getting them to think about, he's planting some seeds right here. And those seeds aren't going to germinate and really do anything, I think, until he has to carry his cross and he has to put his cross in the ground and he has to be nailed to it and he has to die on it. And he has to look at people and say, I'm doing this for you. This is for the forgiveness of your sins. This is for salvation. This is so you can be in heaven with your Father who created you. That's when I think people are going to be motivated. I'm going to do this. I've got to do this. So I think you have to see and hear and understand that whole crucifixion and resurrection and that part of the good news of Jesus Christ and that part of the gospel to go, I'm going to do that too in whatever way I can. Scott.
Well, in the Roman Empire, the man who's carrying the cross, we have the phrase dead man walking. That's what that man is. Everything is forfeit. His life is no longer means it, but Jesus wasn't with it. Calvary, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's peace here, but you can't hang on to anything. Less than God gives us a lot back. I think it's, you've got to give it all. You know, we will to give it all. Because that's what a man carrying the cross has.
Yeah, and while that dead man's walking and that dead man is carrying, the ridicule is beginning, right? That was all part of the process, was the shame of you're a criminal and you're going to die. You had to take on that reproach and that burden too. And he's, I think that's all wrapped up in this statement that Al is asking about, because I think he's saying that's kind of what your life's going to be. And we know we live in a time we don't experience it quite that way. And sometimes that even frustrates us a little bit as Christians, like not getting enough persecution out there. We can't really control that. But I think there are plenty of things about the life we could be living. We could have the whole world, so to speak, or our own world, to Chris's point. And we have to be willing to say, yeah, but I don't want that. I don't need that. There's other work to do. I'm going to sacrifice. I'm going to be willing to give that up. I'm going to do things for other people so they can come to Christ. And that's supposed to send a message. That is the gospel. The gospel is shared by speaking it and preaching it and teaching it to people. And it's shared by example in the lives that we live as Christians. And I think that's all getting wrapped up in this statement here, as he's preparing them and this crowd for what needs to happen. Dan.
Look at the cross and what took him there and how he got there. And then he says, "For whoever's ashamed of me and all and of my words." And then, of course, and we read later in the New Testament, "Thus learned he obedience by the things which he suffered." That taking up the cross is not just going out and doing something sacrificial. Taking up the cross is looking to God's will and following his will like Christ did. And it took all that he had, we see from the Garden in Gethsemane, took all that he had to do that. And so we're looking to God's word and God's direction, and whatever suffering, whatever those things may come, we must be willing to take that. Because it's God's will, not because it's something we decided would be good for us to do. And you know, this is my, you hear people say that, you know, this is my cross to bear. But I think that's in there. I'm not trying to demean any or make this oversimplified. But I see that in there because it was God's will that he came to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that cross was the ultimate end of his obedience to the will of God.
Yeah, very good. When you're denying self, it's in lieu of acknowledging something else. And the self-denial is about the acknowledgement of God's will, right? I'm going to do what it is God would have me to do. So, other thoughts on this? Terry.
I agree with what has been said, but if you could go back to that other slide, just looking at questions 1 and 3, you know, what would this mean to the original audience to hear Peter say that you are the Christ, you are the anointed one, you are the son of David, you are the one in that lineage that has been prophesied for thousands of years. You are that one. And in question 3, how did he communicate that message? I think that would be received, my impression anyway. It is very abrupt because he's turning it upside down. King David was a warrior. He used a sword. No way would he go out in front of the Philistines without a sling or a sword, and surely not a cross. He was a warrior. He was a trained killer. He was very good at that. That's why the king, God exalted him as king. And Jesus is going to be killed? This doesn't make any sense. It turns everything upside down.
Yeah, I like the abrupt comment there. This is abrupt for people when they think they're going to have a king. like David. He is a lamb led to the slaughter. That's what he is. That's what Jesus is. And that's not, that's nothing to glorify in the way man looks at things. That's why Jesus is saying, don't be ashamed of me. I think there's a little bit of like Peter kind of like, we wouldn't let that happen to you. That would be shameful, right? That would be embarrassing for our leader to go down that way. Don't think of it as shame. Don't think of it as shame. You're going to have to change the way you think, because this is going to be abrupt for you. This is going to be challenging for you. But recognize it's the attitude you also have to have and be willing to have. And you can't be ashamed of it. You have to find glory in the cross. You have to find glory in the sacrifice that I'm making. I think it's a really powerful section here. And I think it's not just... I don't think Mark's just, and then this happened, and let me throw another piece in there, and oh yeah, this. I think Mark's given us enough background and enough detail to kind of lead us to some of these really key and critical moments. And I think this moment of you're the Messiah, you're the Christ, therefore we're gonna promote you and put you up on a pedestal and exalt you like a king. And him saying, no, I'm going to be crucified. I'm going to be... destroyed, I'm going to be annihilated in front of people in a shameful way, and them saying, no way, we're not going to let that happen. I think he says, gather around, crowd, this is what it means to be a follower. This is what it means to be a follower, and you got to get your mind wrapped around that. And they still have work to do, I think, to get there. Other thoughts about this? All right, we'll contrast this then with the next section that we go into. And the way I want to do this is we're going to read. We're going to read this next section in Mark chapter 9. And it's going to, I think the highlight verse is going to be, it's the transfiguration. Okay, you can already see that coming. And the end of that transfiguration is God from heaven saying, this is my beloved son. Listen to him. So, there's the will that Dan is talking about. And then from there, I want you to just think about as we read and highlight some of the things Jesus says after that. Because Mark is saying, here's the way I'm going to tell the story. There's this transfiguration moment, and God says, this is my son, listen to him. And then Mark gives us some things that Jesus said that clearly the disciples were supposed to listen to. And I think there are things that we're supposed to listen to as well. And I've just pulled these out of chapter 9 because I want you to think as we read how or if the message that we've had up to chapter 9 is shifting a little bit, and the things that Jesus is saying now are a little bit different and a little more focused and a little more targeted. And see if there's any themes in there as we read them. Don't forget, when's the other time that God from heaven said, this is my beloved son, listen to him? When? At his baptism. That's like roughly 3 years before this. So at the beginning of his ministry, there was a, this is my beloved son, listen to him. Okay, so people have been listening. Now God is going to, specifically with these three disciples that go off with him, but I think by extension, the disciples in general, and certainly everybody, he's going to say it again. And there's some important things that Jesus is going to say from this point forward. So as we go through these, we'll highlight them as we read. And I just want you to think if there are things that are jumping out at you in the things that Jesus is saying now, that maybe we've had this shift a little bit. All right, so we're going to need some readers. So I'm not even going to waste the 5 minutes it would take to raise hands. I'm just going to call on people and ask you to read. So Luke, would you read Mark chapter 9, verses 1 through 8?
And he said to them, truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. Clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, Rabbi, it is good that you are here. Let us make three tents, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah. For he did not know what to say, for they were terrified. cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud. This is my beloved son, listen to me. And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only.
Chris, would you read Mark 9:9-13?
As they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen, until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what could this rising from the dead might be. And they asked him, why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come? And he said to them, Elijah does come first to restore all things. And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they pleased, as it was written of him.
Jeremy, would you read Mark 9:14-20?
When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around him, and the teachers of the law argued with him. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. What are you arguing with him about? He asked. The man in the crowd answered, Teacher, I brought you my son who was possessed by a spirit that has brought him no speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. Ask your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. You unbelieving generation, Jesus replied, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me. So they brought him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming.
Jack, Mark 9:21-29.
Jesus asked his father, how long has this been happening to him? And he said, from childhood. And it has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And Jesus said to him, if you can, all things are possible for one who believes. And immediately the father of the child cried out and said, I believe. Help my unbelief. And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, you mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, he is dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, why could we not cast it out? And he said to them, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer.
Cordell, Mark 9:30-37.
They went on from there and passed through Galilee. And he did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise. But they did not understand the saying and were afraid to ask him. And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, what were you discussing on the way? But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12, and he said to them, if anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all. And he took a child and put him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives not me, but him who sent me.
Brady, Mark 9:38-41.
John said to him, Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not following us. But Jesus said, do not stop him, for no one who does a mighty work in my name will be able soon afterward to speak evil. The one who is not against us is for us. For truly, I say to you, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you belong to Christ will by no means lose his reward.
And Brett, welcome back, Brett. Mark 9:42-50.
Thanks, Dave. But whoever causes one of these little ones to believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and were thrown into the sea. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Better for you to enter into life maimed rather than having two hands to go to hell, into the fire that shall never be quenched, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. And if your foot causes you to 60 feet, to be cast into hell, into the fire which will never be quenched, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye, rather than having two eyes, to be cast into hell, fire, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. Everyone will be seasoned with fire, and every sacrifice will be seasoned with salt. Salt is good.
It's called How to Cover a Chapter in 8 minutes when we're like 2 weeks behind. I want you to think about the statements that are up there, though, and the things that Jesus said, or the times in which Mark says he said something. Coming off of this moment of transfiguration and coming off of, you know, God saying, "This is my beloved Son, listen to him." And I know that means listen to everything and listen to everything he said and everything he will say. I know that. But I think it's interesting to look at after that, what are some of the things Jesus is saying? Do you see or think that there's a shift in any way in where he's going now? Do you think his message is changing a little bit? Do you think his approach is changing at all in some of the things that are highlighted up here? Or is there anything as we go through all of that information in chapter 9 that stands out to you in light of this call to deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow them? Jack?
He doesn't seem to be addressing his deity or the fact that he's the Messiah, but more about this is the things that you're going to have to do, this is how you get along with each other, when he addressed the fact that they were saying who's greater, this is, you know, how to stick to itiveness, if you want to say it that way, because they weren't able to cast the demon out with the prayer. These are the things that can hold you up. What Brett read about, you better to get rid of those and still go to heaven, but not so much who am I.
Okay, good. I like that. Al?
Be short, I think it's all about power. It's all about God's power. He starts off by saying, when he does the transformation, God comes in and says, "I'm here and this is my power and I'm exercising my power through my Son." And now he's going to start saying, "This power is available to you, and this is how you're going to use it. How you're going to paint it."
Yeah.
What you're going to do with it.
Good. Yeah, I like that. I like both of those because it is less about who he is at this point and more about how you need to all work together. It's about how you're going to have the attitude you're going to have when I'm gone. A lot of this is like, imagine me not being here. This is how you have to approach this. There's not a lot of, you don't have faith, you don't have faith, you don't have faith. Even when they say, "Why couldn't we cast it out?" He doesn't go, "Because you don't have faith." He said, "This kind requires prayer. This kind requires, you know, whatever that means. This kind of requires like digging a little bit deeper and appealing to God for some help and some support." So there, to me, there's a little bit of a shift that's going on here in now that he's got the disciples saying, we know who you are and we believe who you are. He's saying, "All right, then let's start talking about what it means to follow me, because you're going to do that even when I'm gone. You're going to follow me. And how you treat each other and how you work with each other, and the attitude you have, and what does it mean to deny self and take up your cross? Well, you got to be willing to get rid of anything, any baggage, anything that causes you to sin, anything that gets in your way, anything that creates a stumbling block from continuing to be a disciple. Better to remove it. It's pointless. You don't need it. You would have a better attitude thinking about it that way and living without it than to try and continue to drag it while you're following me." So I think as we kind of move into this next phase, maybe this final phase of the book of Mark, kind of look for how he shifted the message a little bit and how now he's preparing them to get ready to do the work they got to do once he's gone. Okay? All right. Thank you.